Bob, would you please start by stating your full name and your place and date of birth?
My name is Robert Bob Whaley. I was born in Missoula and on a cold winter day, 1935. My mother was born in Missoula. My father was born in Stevensville. His father was born somewhere in Minnesota, I think, and then they came to Montana in 1863, my grandfather and my great-grandfather. So that gives a little background there. My mother His family was McNulty's from Butte, and so a long Montana legacy as far as my history is concerned. I have a sister, Mary Ann, and a brother, Kellogg. He died in a plane crash in Chicago in 1979, so we lost him when he was pretty young.
Tell me a little bit about what it was like to grow up in Missoula in the 40s.
There was no finer place in the world to grow up than Missoula, Montana in the 40s. Four blocks from Mount Sentinel, right across the street from Bonner Park. All the trees that could be climbed were climbed. The backstop of the tennis court was climbed. Leaps were made over to the shed that they had there for the cover that they had over the picnic tables. And then you would have to jump off that roof to the grass, which is about 8 feet. I think that's where I learned my joy of jumping, led into my smoke jumper days. But Missoula was a great town. I was probably about 15 or 18,000 at that time in the 40s, and went on to Missoula County High School and graduated from there, and then on to Carroll College.
Before we get into college, can you tell me a little bit about some of the games or childhood games, or how did you entertain yourself with your friends and your siblings when you were a kid?
I was always able to entertain myself pretty much, but I had a lot of friends in the neighborhood, a lot of kids, and I was able to round them up from time to time, particularly during World War II. And I'd be the sergeant, and I'd tell them we were going to attack Bonner Park, and we'd start off in the Buck's backyard or the Avery's backyard, and we'd attack across the street, and then and do firing maneuvers across the park, and we would charge through the pool that had water in it. It doesn't have water in it now. They got those sprinkler systems, but and then if we got to the other end of the park without losing anybody, we were victorious. We would beat the Japanese and the Germans, and we defended Missoula, Montana, and particularly Bonner Park. We had great imaginations in those days. One thing I do remember was growing up, I was always envious of, or I honored, I guess you'd say, the Navy and Marine pilots in the Pacific flying off of carriers. And I'd see Flying Leathernecks or Hell Divers of the Navy or some movie like that and come home, and I was 9 or 10 years old. And yet my father's 1939 Chevy parked out there in the driveway and bail out of, first of all, I'd get in a dogfight, and I'd be shooting down Zeros. And then I'd bail out of the car into the Carrigana hedge and proceed to escape and evade through the neighborhood, stealing apples and pulling carrots out of gardens without being detected, and then make my way home probably after about an hour and a half of that all by myself. And the folks would wonder, why won't he eat his dinner? But I can recall doing that a lot. And then we'd round up the kids, and we'd think we'd want to steal apples from somebody's tree. And Mr. Jacobs' house was just down the street from us. He was president of the First National Bank there in Missoula. He had a great apple tree out in the backyard there, and he had a brick stone fence that was about 4 feet off the ground. Went along Hilda Avenue there, and you could jump up on that and get some of the low branches and then climb up into the tree. And I think there were three or four of us that day. I didn't know he was home. I thought this was we were safe, summertime, and the apples were the best ones were up in the top. And I thought, if I go up there, I can get the best apples. And the other guys were down below, grabbing what they could and stuffing them in their pockets. And Mr. Jacobs came out. He says, "You kids, get out of that tree. That's my apple tree. Get out of that tree." Well, as kids will do, they scamper and drop down limb by limb, onto the wall and jump off and scatter out down the alley or wherever they could escape to. I thought, he probably doesn't see me up here because I'm clear up at the top. I've got some pretty good cover here. So I hid up there for just about maybe 30 seconds. And he yells, "You too, Bobby Whaley." And I thought, oh, geez. I scampered down and I head down. It didn't do any good to run because he knew who I was. So I just kind of shamefully walked away and thought, shook my head like, geez, I'm sorry, Mr. Jacobs. But anyway, little things like that that we did. Yeah. Hiking up on Mount Sentinel, we always had three or four of us that go up there and hike Mount Sentinel, clear up to the top, and then back down that trail that they have. I think they call it the Spoke Jumper Trail now. Yeah. Down to the railroad tracks, down the Milwaukee tracks and back. Mm-hmm. So it was it was a lot of fun. Just a lot of fun doing all kinds of things. Swimming at the swimming pool, mm-hmm. going down to the river. They wouldn't let us jump in the river because sometimes it was kind of swift down there, but we had a great time growing up. Great time here.
Do you remember any like songs or verses or anything that you guys sang, or you know how kids sometimes have little songs or poems that they pick up from?
Do you want me to shut the dogs up?
We're picking them up.
Is it distracting?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you shut that off for a second?
Yeah. And if you get up, just make sure you grab that.
Yeah.
That thing there.
I'm going to bring them in because they'll be quiet inside here. Yeah. Stop it. Stop it now. Knock it off. They might be okay. Not as a child. I mean, of course, everybody probably had their childhood games that they played, and mm-hmm. but we weren't much into the singing stuff.
It's all right. Well, let's move on a little bit.
Sure.
Tell me a little bit about your parents. What were their names?
My mother's name was Mary. My father's name was Albert. He went by Doc. He was an optometrist, and red because he had red hair. Mm-hmm. Bitterrooter through and through. My mother was Missoula lady growing up, Missoula County High School. I'm not sure, Willard Grade School, I think, is where she went mm-hmm. when that was open. And when we were children, she stayed home with us, but when we got in the 7th or 8th grade, we were able to come home and take care of ourselves. We only lived three blocks from Paxton School, so we were able to walk back and forth all the time, shoot baskets and play in the park and that sort of thing. So she went back to work for the Forest Service. She'd worked for the Forest Service before we were born, and she went back to work for the Forest Service, and she was, I think, a GS-5 or GS-6 in procurement and supply. Loved her Forest Service career. She really did. She was a woman that was very happy working, and she was good at what she did, very good on shorthand. You'd see her sitting there listening to the radio sometimes or watching television, and she's taking shorthand in her hand just to keep the practice up. So she could take notes very, very, very completely and type crazy. You know, she was real good. So she was real good at.
And what was she like as a mother?
Good mother, yeah, yeah. She loved us, you know, a lot. Yeah.
She strict?
You know, our folks. One reason I don't think we got into trouble was because they trusted us. They always said, "We trust you. We trust you to do the right thing. You have good judgment. You kids will be okay. We're not going to tell you you can't smoke, you can't drink, because you probably will." I never smoked. I still have never smoked. But I started sneaking beers probably when I was a junior in high school. Go out and try to get a case of beer someplace in town and go out and have a beer or two. But never got in any trouble over it. We never abused it. And anybody drink too much, then the other person would drive, make sure they got home okay. We took care of each other. And it was a real brotherhood, a sense of the kids that we ran around with. I ran around with mostly the athletes, the ball players, and other kids too. I mean, I wasn't a cliquish. I got along with just about everybody. I mean, I didn't really have a clique that I ran with. I got along with just about everybody that I associated with. It wasn't a big deal.
We talked a little bit about why you decided to go to Carroll College instead of the University of Montana. Can you talk a little bit about why you made that choice?
I knew that I wanted to get an education. I'm sure that'll go over big. I knew I was tempted to probably become more oriented toward partying here, which was real big in the 50s. Sigma Nu fraternity was putting a lot of pressure on me. My father had been a Sigma Nu, my brother was a Sigma Nu, so I was what they would refer to as a legacy. And I liked them. There were some really good guys in that house, very, very smart people, academically, socially. They participated in all kinds of different community things, and they were really good Key Club guys. In fact, we started Key Club here in Missoula when I was a sophomore or junior. We got that program going. I was a state treasurer my senior year. And between Key Club and the sports and Boys State, I just knew too many kids coming to the university. And I thought, I'll go over to Carroll where I don't know anybody and start out again. And I did, and I enjoyed it. It was a challenge academically. They made you work, and I wasn't used to that. I could squeeze by without studying too hard in high school, and they gave me a scholarship, which I immediately lost my second semester. But I really enjoyed it. I was not going to go back, and then the dean of men came over and took me out to dinner one night, and he said, "We'd really like you to think about coming back." He says, "We'd like to have you back here." And I told him, I said, "Are you that hard up for students?" And he kind of liked my response, I guess. And then when I went home that night, my dad asked me what I was going to do if I had made my decision. And he kind of wanted me to come to the university here. My mom wanted me to be at home. And I said, "I think I'm going to go back. I think I'll go back to Carroll." He said, "Well, I have to tell you, Bobby," he said, "anybody that would take the time to come over here and talk to one of the students into coming back when they thought that maybe he wouldn't," I said, "says a lot for the institution." And from then on, grades went up. I got more oriented to the system and played football over there. Got injured my first year, didn't play my second year, played my third year. And then ended up being the student body president my senior year, and we had comprehensive examinations and all that sort of thing, so I didn't get to play. I was too busy with all of the other things I had going on over there my senior year, so I didn't play that year.
And you ended up getting a degree in?
Political science, economics, that history, that sort of thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where did you go after college?
Well, hearkening back to my time in the cockpit of my dad's 1930 Chevy, and several of the guys over at Carroll were going into what they call the NAVCAD program, Naval Aviation Cadet Program. They didn't have to have a degree. They're going after their second year. They had to have 2 years of college. So with that, I got to know some of the students that were going into the university or going into the NAVCAD program. And then I wonder if my wife can hear that.
It'll stop.
I don't even know if she's here.
It's okay.
Okay, all right, good.
Don't worry about
all right. So I got oriented to that, went over and took some tests, and they showed that I could get through the program probably okay. And then, I wanted to graduate. I did want to graduate, so this was my sophomore year when we were doing this. So I figured that it would be nice to go through the Marine Corps. Because they had a Marine recruiter came in there, a captain, and his dress blues, and he looks really sharp and all that. But he said, "We have an Air Officer Candidate Program for graduates, and therefore you may want to apply for that," which I did. So I went back out to Seattle, took more tests and passed those, and then was accepted into the Air Officer Candidate Program, went back to Quantico and got commissioned there, and then went on down to Pensacola for 18 months of flight training there. Mm-hmm. And so that's where what got me oriented into the Marine Corps and flying. And I'd always wanted to fly because we didn't live that far from the old Hale Field, which was where Sentinel High School is now. Okay. It was about a 10-minute ride on my bike, and I used to go out there and watch the planes take off and land all the time. And the smoke jumpers had a little paraloft out there. They packed chutes and stuff. And so right from that time, I was a little kid, I thought, I don't know if I can do that or not, but if I ever could, I'd sure like to give it a try. And so I figured, why not? So.
What do you think it was about flying that caught your attention?
Probably jumping off the roof of that shed over there in Bonner Park and figuring that there's no way I was going to get out of this thing until I hit the ground, but I'd rather be able to get out and maybe fly around a little bit and see something without having to hit the ground. And I did have a flight. My dad took me out with my sister one time when I was about 6 or 7, and she was about 5. And Bob Johnson was a pilot. He's famous old Bob Johnson from the Johnson Flying Service here. And my dad was sitting up in this seat over here, and he was the pilot seat. And my sister and I were back here. And he looked back at me, and he says, "Well, Bobby, what do you think about this?" And my sister says, "Man, watch that road." You know, and so he got a big charge out of that, I guess. But anyway, that was really exciting to me to get up in that plane and fly around and look at Missoula and look at the M and all the things around here. And I thought, boy, I wonder if I could ever do this. Mm-hmm. And then I was bit.
So you spent 18 months in Pensacola mm-hmm. in training, and mm-hmm. then is that when you were stationed in Oceanside?
No, that came quite a while after that. After my flight training, I went to my first squadron at Santa Ana, California, near El Toro, and then spent a year there, and then we went overseas. Mm-hmm. And but it was supposed to be for 13 months, but I extended an extra 5 months because they needed pilots. This is when we first went into Vietnam in 1962 in April, and then the squadron went home after being there until August, I think it was. And then 4 of us extended up back up in Okinawa, thinking we could get back down with the replacement squadron. And they needed pilots really bad up there because there was nobody around to fly. And so we had helicopters there that we were able to support the Marine division that was stationed there in Okinawa at the time, and got a lot of flight time in and had collateral duties as assistant airfield operations officer and that sort of thing. So it was really a good experience. And then from there I went to Hawaii for 2 years.
Right.
So.
Would you be willing to talk about your first tour in Vietnam a little bit?
Yeah, it was very, very interesting because we were the first squadron to go into Vietnam during that long war. We were cleared out in the Mekong Delta, the very southern part, working with the Army. There was one Army helicopter squadron that we had dropped off there at Christmas time. And we came in 4 months later in April. And so they were up in the Saigon area, and we were down in the southern part of the island, of the country. And just a lot of support for the Vietnamese people, the Vietnamese Army, the ARVN, they call them, Army of Vietnam. Popular forces, we supported them a lot. They had little hamlets, and we would try to keep them safe. And we would carry a lot of troops into combat situations, trying to trap the Viet Cong and get them engaged. And we had a lot of medevacs that we'd pick up. Two aircraft, 4 of us pilots, made the first night medevac of the Vietnam War. With Colonel Van was the advisor with the Army, and he said that the morale went up substantially with his troops when he saw that we would come in at nighttime and pick up the wounded. The only reason I think I got to go is because I had been into the Thon Son Nhut Airport at night before, and that's where we had to drop the wounded because that's where they had their medical battalion there to care for them.
And that was a local airport or an Army airport?
Thon Son Nhut was the main airport in Saigon.
Okay.
So, but anyway, they wanted to know who'd ever been up there, and I said I hadn't. It was late at night or fairly late at night, and so I got to be one of the pilots. Mm-hmm. It was good thing to do.
And that was a helicopter?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so on your first tour, you were in a helicopter mm-hmm. squadron.
Yes.
And what was that called again?
It's called the H-34. Mm-hmm. and made by Sikorsky Aircraft. Good troop aircraft. Real solid aircraft. I mean, it's like the DC-3 of the fixed-wing community. I mean, you could just haul all kinds of stuff. Ran. Take a lot of hits. Never. The most vulnerable part in the aircraft was probably behind the sticks.
What are the sticks?
The pilots.
Yeah.
The control sticks.
The control sticks.
Yeah.
That makes sense. You alluded to having been involved in an accident in a helicopter.
Actually, a couple of them. I didn't tell you about the first one. That was in Hawaii, and we were flying at nighttime and evading another aircraft that was coming in, making his approach, and I had just finished what they call a ground control approach, or a GCA, and had handed the aircraft off to the other guy, and I told him we were getting low, and I said, "You have 300 feet, Don," and he didn't add power, he just kept taking it off, and I was watching the jet go by me like this, and we slammed into the bay there at Kaneohe Bay, and tipped over upside down, and I was just lucky to get out, just plain lucky. But it wasn't my time, just wasn't my time yet. Everybody got out, and I did nothing right. It was just, I happened to luck out. So, the second one was on my second tour in Vietnam, and lost a tail rotor at 1,100 feet. We were covering a retrograde operation. A battalion landing team had gone in. There was a North Vietnamese battalion that had been licking their wounds after having been engaged with the Vietnamese Army. And we were in there to harass them and do whatever we could to make sure that they didn't get re-engaged with anybody. So we were in there for about 5 days, and it was a typical vertical envelopment operation, helicopters by air, LVTs across the beach, pinching movement, very successful. And we were just covering the last of the four helicopters that were picking up the last troops on the beach. And my wingman and I, we were 180 degrees apart, and so you always have somebody covering like this. And I had just given the aircraft to my co-pilot. And 1,100 feet, I knew the time of day, airspeed and all that stuff, because you always check those things as a pilot before you give it to the other aircraft commander or pilot. And wham, boy, we started spinning around like this just terribly. And everything I did seemed to be wrong, because our manuals that we had at that time said, try to put the nose forward so you could windstream the thing and get out of that terrible spin that you're in. Well, it was probably relegated to an Army D model, which is a lot longer aircraft than our Huey E models. And every time I did that, the nose would tip like this, and now I was going down like this and still spinning, and we're just shuddering like you can't believe. So I thought, when all else fails, what you do is auto-rotate. You split the engine, you just roll off the power from the collective and reduce the momentum of the rotor going around, because it's no longer being driven by the engine, and you're now free falling down, and the wind is going through the rotors and helping to sustain you. Well, the important thing is you have to remember is to make sure that you pull on the collective so you take a bite out of the blades and you cushion your crash. Well, everything was vibrating so badly in the aircraft, I couldn't even tell how high we were. All I could see was the ocean, the sand, and the jungle, ocean, sand, and jungle. So I landed very, very hard. I crashed very hard, but at least we were upright. Because if we'd been sideways, we would have rolled up and probably burned. And we all got broken backs out of it. So anyway, that was an experience. First ones to live through that type of an accident that high with the loss of a tail rotor. So anyway, that's what sent me to the hospital.
Right. And did that effectively finish your second tour?
It did, very effectively, as a matter of fact. That did effectively end my second tour.
And now you also flew a fixed wing plane.
That was my next tour.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when did you go back?
3 weeks after I was married, as a matter of fact, October of 1968. Mm-hmm. So I went back to a squadron, the same squadron I was in when I had my crash with flying the Hueys. And I had instructed for 2.5 years approximately at Camp Pendleton at Oceanside, and had a lot of my students that were in this follow-on squadron I went back to, which was VMO 6. I was in VMO 6 in 65 and VMO 6 in 68, 69. Mm-hmm. The difference was this time I had brought in the OV-10 twin turboprop aircraft, the Bronco. And that's the one that I was flying when I, when I wrote up my little story about the pink elephants.
Yeah.
And that was a very, very rewarding tour. I mean, we really had a got into a lot of situations where you were able to put firepower on the bad guys so the good guys could get out. A lot of recon teams we saved, Army and Marine, and saved a lot of lives by doing that. Escorted a lot of helicopters in their inserts and extracts. Saw some beautiful country. It was really, Vietnam is a gorgeous country. It really is, very beautiful. And but I also got to fly the Huey at the same time because I was qualified in that, and sometimes they'd run short of pilots, and so I'd jump on the left seat and help them do inserts and gunships and that sort of stuff.
And what was your rank at that point?
I was a major then. I was a captain when I crashed in 1965, and then I was a major in 1968.
Okay. And you mentioned a particular trip, or I believe it was a reconnaissance trip on your own, where you ended up crossing the border into Laos because you discovered something.
Operation Dewey Canyon was probably one of the most successful operations that the Marines ran in Vietnam up to that point, probably the whole war. The Ho Chi Minh Trail was not just one trail road network, it was a multiple road networks coming in from Laos. And the command post, the CP that the 9th Marines had was on a hillside, overlooking down, going down into the Ashau Valley. And they were getting hit pretty hard with artillery, and nobody could figure out where it was coming from. And one day I happened to be on a visual reconnaissance mission up there, and the light was just right. It was shining into this little opening, and I could see some boxes under there, some containers of some sort. And my back seat was always occupied by an aerial observer. And I said, "Do you see that down there?" And he says, "Yes, sir." He says, "I've got it." And I said, "Where is it?" And he said, "It's about 1,000 meters inside Laos." And I said, "Can they reach the command post with the Artie?" And I said, "I think they can, depending on what they've got." And he said, "Oh, yeah." He said, "They can reach it." And I said, "I think we need to call in an airstrike." So I called in some Marine A-4 Skyhawks, fast-moving jets, and ran an airstrike on them. And we had, I think, 27 secondary explosions that came out of that thing. And my relief was coming on station at that time, and my call sign was Seaworthy Whiskey. The squadron's call sign was Seaworthy, and I kept Whiskey. And he says, "Hey, Whiskey, leave me some. Let me run a few of those guys." So I said, "Okay." So I moved south and into an orbit so that I could see, watch what was going on. And he continued to run these flights of air, which they were just scrambling like crazy, and they were hitting everything around it. And I didn't realize at the time that I was moving further into Laos, but this time I was probably 4 clicks into Laos, 4,000 meters. And all of a sudden, anti-aircraft fire is coming up in front of my nose. And orange balls. They probably were leading me more because they were used to leading jets, so they lead them more because they thought they were going faster. Mm-hmm. And there's no way I could get out of that pattern that they had. I mean, I couldn't fly out of it. And the only way I could do it was what we call a split S maneuver, which is you just roll the aircraft inverted like this, pull back on the stick as hard as you can, and hope you got enough altitude to pull out before you go into the trees. But I knew that we did. Mm-hmm. My back seat had no idea what was going on. He was all over the back cockpit, pencils flying and knee boards and everything else. And they pulled out, and fortunately, there was a no problem. We got out of it okay, but it was very, very close. Wow. Yeah, very close. Anyway, that was exciting.
Yeah.
That's there's a write-up on it the kid from the Sea Tiger, which is a newspaper that the division had, he wrote that up in a little article, and I have that.
Oh, that'd be fun to see.
Yeah.
Before we move on, is there anything else that you want to say about your experience overseas?
Served with some of the finest people I've ever met in my life. Dedicated, honest, good people. I don't know how many people can say that they would trust their lives to the people you work with, but we all could. We know if we got in trouble, they'd come and get us. They'd be there, even if it cost them their life, because that was what we were dedicated to doing. I mean, that was exactly what we were dedicated to doing. A lot of guys at that time were getting out of the Marine Corps and going with airlines, and much more remunerative. I mean, we weren't making very much money in those days. And somebody asked me, I said, Bob, why don't you go with the airlines? And I said, because I know what I'm doing, I think I'm pretty good at what I do, and my troops need me over there. They need me in that environment because I knew how to handle things. I knew how to get people out, and I knew that I had a feeling that you never know whether you're going to come back or not. I mean, that's not something you worry about because it's not in your hands anyway. But the better you are, the better chances you have of coming back. And I just thought that that's where I belong now. I belong where I am. I don't want to be anyplace else. And when I married Luana, I said, and I was a major at the time. I was 33 years old. And I said, don't expect me to fly like a married man. I will always fly like a bachelor. She says, I wouldn't expect you to fly any other way. I said, good.
You knew it was a good choice.
It was a good choice, yep. Yep. I knew it was a good choice.
Is there anything that you feel like, you alluded to this a little bit 2 weeks ago, but is there anything that you feel like you brought back from Vietnam, just in your personal life and how that experience affected?
Oh, I think we all brought something back that much time over there, experiences that we had, the people we lost. I lost 56 friends flying, not all from Vietnam, but most of them. Guys I would be having lunch with one day and the next day they were gone. So I think there's a little bit of survivor guilt that you feel because you wonder why wasn't it me? And then you always have the risk of being overrun by the bad guys because they were good at that. They could sneak into the wire and sapper us and do that sort of thing. So I always had a weapon beside my bunk, cot or whatever I happened to be on. And I still have one. I have one beside my bed. I've got a Colt 45. I have clips in it. It's not ready to go. I mean, I'd have to make sure that I went through the proper procedures before I would engage anything. But I feel good having that. In a restaurant or a bar, I always like to have my eye on the door. I don't like sitting with my back to anything that I can't see. I used to drive Luana crazy, rub my feet together like this, my soles together, before I get into bed because I had to get the sand off. That went on for 2 years, and she, oh, geez, there's no sand in this house. I shook that one. Hunting, I don't like to kill anything. I used to fish a lot. I don't fish much anymore. I don't bird hunt. I don't big game hunt. I haven't done any big game hunting at all. Just kind of feel that, I guess when you've been in that environment, that life is too precious. And I'm not against it at all. I'll go out with the guys, hope they get something. Mm-hmm. But I won't be the one pulling any triggers. Been there, done that.
Fair enough. Shall we move into your Irish heritage?
Sure, yeah.
You need a break? Or are you
no.
good?
No. I could use some water, yeah. Excellent. Yeah, let's take a little break.
Let's take a little break.
You guys, how's your water?
I've got some.
Okay. How about the background noise with the dogs might be a little.
That gives us a sense of ambiance.
Yeah.
Your daily life.
Yeah.
Your daily background noise. All right. Again, I'll ask mm-hmm. you some more questions in there.
Sure.
And just feel free to interject with anything else that you want to.
Okay. Sounds good.
Could you tell me how you and Luana met?
I had, Luana and I met when I was still assigned to Oak Knoll Naval Hospital in Oakland, California, when I was recuperating from that Huey crash. Mm-hmm. And I was a godfather to one of my squadron mate's little girl when I was stationed in Hawaii at Kaneohe Bay. And her third birthday was coming up. So I wanted to go over for her for the birthday. And I had been recuperating enough so that I was ambulatory now. I wore a back brace, but I was ambulatory. And if you wore your uniform, you could get on the flight for $55, half fare. So I had my uniform on. So I got on the flight, and it happens to be that Luana was a flight attendant. She was a nurse. She'd gone to Sacred Heart School of Nursing over in Spokane, and she had worked in Hawaii. And while she was there, they came and they were recruiting nurses because they had to have nurses on the overwater flights for United. So she was on that flight as a reason of why her background and her training. And the nurses at the hospital had thrown me a little party the night before I left. And I wasn't used to drinking very much, obviously. But I had probably a few more beers than I should have. So when I got on board, I told her, I asked her, would it be okay if I eat a little later so you don't need to serve me right away if you're what your intention is? And she says, no, that's fine. This was a 707, I think. And they only had about 12 or 15 passengers on board. It was really, really light. So I sacked out there for a little while, something I'm prone to do when I fly, unfortunately. And I got up and went back to the head and walked by the two flight attendants, stewards as they called them then, and a guy was sitting there. And most of the other passengers were on their way down to Hawaii and then on to Johnson Island, which was a military contract thing that they had going on there. And I didn't hear him say anything, so I was coming back, the guy looks up at me and says, what's the matter, Captain, are you stuck up? And I said, what? And I wasn't in any position to smack him, because he'd have beat me up, probably because I had a back brace on and couldn't hit back. But I wouldn't have done that anyway. I mean, it was just, I said, I beg your pardon. And he said, well, I asked you if you wanted to have a drink with us when you went back. And I said, I didn't hear you, I'm sorry. Well, would you like to? And I said, sure, if it's all right with the ladies. And I sat down there and started talking. And where are you from and so forth? Well, she's from Boise, you know, I'm from Missoula. And she said, well, Missoula. She says, I went to Sacred Heart School of Nursing and some of my good friends are from Missoula. And do you know so-and-so? And I said, no. Martha Johnson? I said, no. Her brother's Roger Johnson. I said, Roger Johnson? I said, oh, my God. Yes, I know Roger Johnson. We're classmates. We did some serious partying when we were in high school. And he's the one who owns Pyramid Lumber up here in Sealy Lake and runs that outfit. It has for a long, long time. I think he's probably just chair of the board or something like that now. But anyway, so there was a connection there. And I thought, boy, she's a pretty cute gal. I mean, I've been locked up here for a long time in the hospital. And I wonder if she'd go out with me tonight. So we were getting ready to let down into Honolulu there. And they walked around the plane those days, you know, they'd spray kill anything that's coming in from the States. And I said, would you care to go to dinner tonight, Luana? She said, we can't date the passengers. It's against the rules. And I said, oh, it's probably a pretty good rule, good regulation. But she did give me her telephone number in San Francisco. And at that time, my father had died just before I crashed. So, and my mother had transferred from Missoula to San Francisco for the Forest Service in Region 5, so she was there. And so I knew that I'd probably have a chance to see her again. Because in the last month or so, I was able to go to my mother's apartment and stay there with her, and then go back to the hospital twice a week just for checkups and so forth. So anyway, now we're on the way to the hotel, and I happened to be in the same limo with her. And I said, well, now that you're no longer in flight status, I said, how can you go? And she says, I'm still in uniform. She was tough, really tough. But I got enough information out of her. I knew when she was coming back. And it happened to be the day that, of the birthday, 4 days later. So I went to the hotel and found out that she was out shopping. Our Lady of the Mall, I call her here. And caught her when she was coming back up the steps. And I said, Luana, I said, Bob, I said, what are you doing tonight? She said, nothing. I said, you want to go to a birthday party? My goddaughter is 3 years old, and they live over in Kaneohe. And I said, I'd like you to go with me if you would. She says, okay. She couldn't come up with an excuse. And the rest is history. We dated for 2 years, I guess. That was 66, yeah, 2.5 years. And
were you married in San Francisco?
No, we're married at, I was stationed, right after that I got out of the hospital. I got reassigned to the squadron down at Camp Pendleton, and that's where I was training for 2.5 years, replacement pilots, where we picked up the OV-10, got checked out on that aircraft. And then she would come down and visit. She had her room, I had my room, I had a house in San Clemente, and she was very, very strict. Convert to Catholicism from being a Methodist, and she was right down the line. Boy, she was straight arrow all the way, which is fine with me. I mean, it was okay with me all the way. I really got to love her. She became a good friend first, and then I really, she knocked my socks off. So we got married at San Juan Capistrano Mission, and then 3 weeks later, I was gone for 13 months.
Mm-hmm. And how were you still able to communicate during that period when you were gone?
Letters only.
Letters.
Yeah. Letters only. They don't have the conveniences we have today for cell phones and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But it was she wrote frequently, and I had a lot of support from the family too. All the families were really good to us. I mean, nobody was hurting for mail or goodies and things like that. It was really important.
And did you and Luana ever have any children?
No, we couldn't. Didn't find that out until I was about 38. And then we wanted to adopt, and they said it would be over a 2-year wait if you wanted a child. And in those days, they wouldn't adopt if you were over 40 years old. Mm. So that was really a pretty sad situation. We went through Catholic Social Services and Lutheran Social Services, and they had the same rules. So we just love our dogs and our nephews and nieces and neighborhood kids and anybody else that then comes to the door.
Well, you've established quite a relationship with animals in your life.
Always have, always though. We've always loved animals. Our whole family is that way. And Luana's the same way. She's worse than I am. I mean, she just cares for these guys. They've got health problems, and she takes care of those health problems. I mean, she's a real nurse. Mm-hmm. I mean, daily stuff that has to be done for them. Ears, medications. She's just always on duty. That's why we never go anywhere. But we do want to go to New Zealand next year, so.
Excellent.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk a little
talk about the family,
your
history.
Irish
yeah.
History. So, why don't you start just by talking about Peter Patrick
mm-hmm.
Whaley, your great-great-grandfather.
My great-grandfather.
your great-grandfather, and your great-grandmother, and just start from there.
Peter Whaley came to this country in 1841, and he left the rest of the family in Ireland until they could get enough money to come, which he would send them. And they came about 1847, that time frame. I don't know where they all, I think there were six kids in the family. The one I'm most familiar with is that was my great-great-grandfather that came. My great-grandfather was Peter, the son of the other Peter Whaley. So my great-grandfather came here about 1847 with the rest of the family. And he came from County Carlow, Tullow, yeah. And was a 49er, and when they discovered gold, he came to California in 1850, had to hike across the Isthmus of Panama, and took another ship up, which had some real problems, I guess. They got stuck because they ran out of wood, and some of them were, I guess, wood-fed for their steerage, for their power. And then did fairly well there in 1850. Had some good luck, and then came back. The family then was in Minnesota, around St. Paul, Minneapolis, St. Paul. So came back, and then decided to go back to California again, 1851, 1852, and didn't do well at all that time. Then came back to Minnesota again, married my great grandmother Hannah, who was from Somerset, Ohio. And then my grandfather was born in 1860, January, and they decided to go west when gold or silver was discovered in Colorado City. So they came across the plains, covered wagons, obviously. No Amtrak in those days.
Not yet.
No. And went to Colorado City in 1860, and then 1861, 1862, and then 1863, gold was discovered in Bannock, and then they packed up again and went to Bannock in 1863, and from there to a little town called Diamond City over by Townsend, and started a store there. And after that, he was tabbed to be the Indian agent up on the Flathead Reservation. He was one of the third, I think, Indian agent up there, and stayed there for almost 2 years. A dyed-in-the-wool, hard-nosed Democrat Catholic who would not give anything to the Republican administration when it came in, and lost his job. He was a major. They always give them the rank of major, which makes them, I guess, more powerful with on the reservations, and it gives them some status, I guess. But anyway, so he lost that job, and then he went down and homesteaded down the Bitterroot, down around Stevensville there, and built the Whaley House, which is there today, outside of the Lee Metcalf Reserve. So that's pretty much that history, that part of it. There are other Whaleys that, and then they had children. My grandfather, of course, was the first, and then six more girls and boys. Mm-hmm. And they stayed pretty much in this area until the 30s, I guess, and went out to the coast and down to California and around. But quite an interesting background. Now, you really have no idea how tough these pioneers were and what they went through and what they had to do to get body and soul, keep body and soul together, particularly with a lot of children. Mm-hmm. It must not have been easy. They had to be really, really dedicated and really tough. And there were a lot of Irish here in Montana in those days. And a lot of others, too. I mean, they're not just the Irish. There are a lot of Italians and Germans, and a lot of different cultures came here and made Montana what it is today. Yeah. Really did.
And how much of your heritage is Irish?
My grandfather, of course, on my father's side. My grandmother, my great-grandfather on my father's side, my great-grandmother, or my grandmother on my father's mother, she was a Griffith, and she had Irish connections. My mother's side, she was a McNulty, So the McNulty's from Butte are the, that's where her heritage came from. Mm-hmm. So 3 out of 4 fairly close, I'd say, and English, Welsh probably thrown in there. Mm-hmm. Pretty much Northern Europe, obviously.
Yeah.
British Isles, I would guess.
Yeah. So. You got to go to Carlow.
I did.
You got to visit Carlow. Mm-hmm. And
Wicklow.
What year?
That was 1998.
So in 1998,
yeah,
you got to visit,
mm-hmm,
Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me about that?
driving on the left-hand side of the road in those narrow roads was not a lot of fun. It took a little bit of getting used to. The first day we went, drove from the, wherever the ferry point was there, we came in from Wales, because we went to England first and stayed with a friend there, distant relative, actually. He was a lieutenant colonel in the Army Air Corps during World War II, and his wife died, but he had a gal he had met when he was in the Army before he was ever married, and her husband died, so they got together and got married, and she had a wonderful place over there in southern England, and so we went over there to spend about 3 days before we went over to Ireland. And so that was really, really nice to do that. But I got a car that first day there and rented that car and drove around the parking lot on the left-hand side so I could get used to making turns, left-hand turns, making sure you're okay there, but the right-hand turns are what I had to get used to, the roundabouts and that sort of thing. We drove up to Wicklow, and that's where the Whaley Abbey is, and went in there to see Whaley Abbey, which was founded by Buck Whaley back in the 1600s or 1700s, somewhere around there.
And who was Buck Whaley?
He was a great-great-great uncle, a really ne'er-do-well guy. He was a gambler, never married, probably see why. He made a bet with a guy one time that he could walk all the way to the Holy Land. And he got on a boat and walked the whole time he was on the boat, they said. I can't believe it. But then just the part that he couldn't hike. So he hiked on the boat, walked on the boat, going across the English Channel, walked across Europe, and then across the Mediterranean, I guess, probably a small part of it, and walked the whole time he was on the boat there, and he won the darn bet.
Do you know what they bet?
It was a pretty substantial sum of money.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did he ever make it back to Ireland?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He came back. Yeah. Anyway, that was Buck. Nobody talks about him that much, but my dad always liked to tell the stories about him, and my granddad. Anyway, then we just drove around Ireland and took out those little markers and wiped out a few side view mirrors. And when I turned the car, and both of the hubcaps were gone on the left-hand side. And I didn't take them. I mean, who's going to steal hubcaps when you spend $3,000 to go to Ireland and everything, or whatever it was? But I told the lady, I said, you know, I don't think you put them on. The first place, you knew you were renting this car to a Yank, and you've had problems with us before. She says, no, I don't think so. She says, you could have taken those off and sold them. I said, I don't even know how to get into the trunk to get the jack out. Because it had one of these key things, and we were driving Volkswagens at the time. Hell, I didn't know how to handle all this newfangled stuff with these cars, and hit this and button and that button and everything else. So we had all of our stuff in the back seat. I didn't ever use the trunk. And I told her that. I said, I think you knew that, and I don't think you even put those on in the first place. And she says, well, that's the first time I've ever heard that one. I says, that's a good one. It's a good one. She says, I'll not be charging you. I said, thank you. But anyway, that little poem I came up with the second day, we were going down this real narrow, narrow street, and I didn't know what the rules were. When the first guy that gets into the open space there on the street has the right-of-way, and there was a truck, a lorry, they call them, coming toward me, and I thought I had the right-of-way. And he thought he had the right of way. We both get in there and squeeze in. So in my side view mirror on the left side, I'm driving on the right side. I didn't have the space there to give the differential. And I hit his, and mine went back, and his went back. And then about 2 hours later, we're at a construction site, and I knocked out those orange cones, those were good. A couple of those went flying, and a lot of stuff like that. And so I thought, and I started smiling. I came up with this little poem. Side mirrors meshing, wheels to curbs brushing, avoiding the trams and barrows. Then looming ahead is that dreaded sign, that sign that says, road narrows. Holy shit. And that was the way I just drove. I mean, that was it. I was very cautious. We got B&Bs that were close to the pubs and the restaurants, and so we walked to them and walked back because the guardie is very, very tough over there. Yeah, and I didn't want to have anything to do with that, so. It was a wonderful trip, really a great trip.
Excellent.
Yeah.
You alluded to one of the Peters, I can't remember, may or may not have been involved with the IRA.
Great grandfather Peter, when he was young, 12, 13 years old, what I heard was that he would carry messages back and forth for meetings that they would have, clandestine meetings, whether it was a mass that was illegal at the time that they were going to have for some farmers or whatever, or a meeting of this or that. They never put anything in writing. So that was what I heard that he had participated in. And bless his heart if he did. I mean, they were treated very, very badly over there in those years by the British. There was really no love for the British at all. In fact, World War I, the Irish were rooting for the Germans. I mean, it was just that nature. Mm-hmm. Even World War II, I'm not so sure that they were all excited about who to vote for. Yeah. But they had some good Irish military units that fought for the British and the Allies. But yeah, that was something that allegedly happened.
And do you know exactly what the initial impetus was for your great-grandfather to leave?
I don't. 1841 was before the famine. I think the famine was 1843, that era there. Although they were not, it just didn't happen in 1843. They'd been hard put for a long, long time there, real stressed. And I just don't think my great-great-grandfather felt it was a place that he wanted to raise a family, and there was an opportunity to come to America. And he said, that's the next place we're going. We're not going to stay and put up with that stuff. So that's probably the rationale that I can come up with at this time from what I know.
What does your Irish ancestry mean to you?
There's a lot of pride in being Irish, as there is a lot of pride for Italians to be Italian, Germans to be German, Swedes to be Swedes, Norwegians to be Norwegians. I think if you're fortunate enough to have enough of a nation, a country's blood in your background, and it's been foisted upon you, or you've had a chance to learn a little bit about it, there's an interest there if you take it, and if you want to pursue it. That to me is something to have some pride in. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're all mongrels. I mean, there's no doubt about that. We're all mongrels to a very large degree. But if you can break out the thoroughbred a little bit, and put your money on that, then why not?
Now you're a member of the AOH.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about that. How long have you been a member?
I think I was with the first group that started it. And it's been active and deactivated, not deactivated, but inactive and active again and then inactive. And Pat Toomey right now is doing a really good job and keeping it going. And sometimes there'll only be three or four of us that show up at a meeting, but we wanted to keep it going. The biggest function we have is a St. Paddy's Day parade, but we wanted to make sure that we did other things too that might be of help to our heritage. Mm-hmm. So we're expanding out a little bit more. The things that we did at the Roxy Theater, and of course the Area Studies program, and mm-hmm. other things that are going on that we're trying to make sure we participate in.
And what sort of roles have you played or distinguished sort of awards or anything that you've been given by AIOH?
Well, they made me Irishman of the Year because nobody else would take it in 2002. John Agnew was our president, I think, at the time, and he said, "You're going to be our Irishman of the Year." And I said, "No way, come on." So many other guys out there that have done a lot more than I have. And he said, "Yeah, but..." Well, I used to, after our St. Paddy's Day party we would have, I'd stay and clean up, help fold tables and sweep and mop and do that sort of thing, the inglorious stuff. And I think he probably appreciated the fact that somebody has to do that stuff, so why not me? I mean, and I think that's why he probably rewarded me with that.
It's all about the little things.
Little things, yeah. Yeah.
What other organizations are you involved in, and what other hobbies are meaningful?
Well, I like to hike, backpack. We don't do that much backpack anymore because Coda does not want to mind very well when she gets in the woods. But car camping, golf, like golf, volunteer things. I was a member of the Five Valleys Land Trust for about 12 years, and I'm still in their finance council, finance committee. Chair of the finance council at St. Francis for a number of years. Smoke Jumper Trail Crew. Been doing that. We had our 13th year this year. Been that, on that since the start. Member of the Purple Heart Society of America, National Organization of Purple Heart, and Distinguished Flying Cross Society.
Were you awarded with a Purple Heart?
Mm-hmm. And Distinguished Flying Cross. American Legion, life member. Disabled American Veterans, life member, just things that are militarily oriented. Was on the board of directors for 10 years, I believe it was, with Marine Combat Helicopter Association. Just got off of that 2 years ago.
And what did that entail?
We have a reunion every 2 years and get together. There's a lot of details that have to go on in putting that together. The East Coast 1 year, West Coast another 2 years after that. Membership drives, finance things that we have to deal with, rules, regulations. It's a 501c3 organization, so you have to comply with the IRS and a lot of different things. So everybody had enough to do. You weren't busy all the time with it, but when it came time, crunch time came, you're busy.
Yeah.
So that was good. But I had to drop out of that because I had another 2 years left on my term, but the guy that was running the Smoke Jumper Trail Crew program died of a heart attack very suddenly, and I took over his job in trying to make sure that we got the trail crews out that year. He died in June, and our crews went out in July, and so I pulled the committees together and made sure that we were stabilized as far as personnel were concerned to handle key jobs, key billets, and it's up and running. So that was really important at that time. That takes a lot of my time.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's about the extent of what I have planned to talk about. Is there anything else that, at least at this setting, sitting here, that you'd like to say or offer?
No, that's more than I thought we were going to be talking about. But you made very good notes the other day, so obviously.
What I'd love to do, Bob, is maybe take a little short tour of the house, and if there's anything that you'd like to show us, you know, I'd love to see the portraits of your of your great grandparents, and perhaps the room that you showed me last time I was here.
Sure. Yeah.
And anything else that you want to show us and just quickly describe to us would be great. And then, as I mentioned before about this, kind of what I was thinking when we were talking is that because it is long, in what I find the most moving and the most important, it kind of comes in the middle and toward the end. I wonder if you would be willing to sort of sort of summarize the beginning of how this story kind of started and what, like the beginning of that day, as it were, and just sort of briefly explain what was happening, and then kind of at the point where you guys see the elephants, maybe if you'd be willing to read that part, I think it would be really powerful, really an interesting thing to have.
Sure. Yeah.
So I'll give you that, and you can look at it, and just maybe before we get up and move.
Do you want to do it right now?
Would you mind?
No,
just,
not at all.
Just take all the time you need to think about that. If you don't want to read the whole thing, I understand.
Right.
You can
kind
of explain to us what that day was, and then maybe read the last couple of pages.
That tour that I had in Quang Tri was, like I said, I flew helicopters and fixed wing both. And the OB-10 was the reconnaissance aircraft that was armed with four forward firing M60 machine guns and rocket pods. I had, I think it was 26 rockets on board. And the primary mission was reconnaissance, going out looking for the trails, the Ho Chi Minh trails and so forth that came down from North Vietnam. The very northwest corner was my sector of responsibility. To the east, to the west was Laos, to the north was North Vietnam. And we were flying over the Khe Sanh combat base. Khe Sanh was a very hard-fought battle there in early 1968. And off to the east there, this mountain was called Tiger Mountain, about 5,600 feet high, always covered in clouds because of the high humidity. Of course, the cooler air at the top, when the humidity would go up there and form clouds. And I had a back seat, a new young lieutenant who had just, he had extended his tour over there for six more months just so he could fly in the back seat of the OB-10s because he was so impressed with the job that we did for him when he was an infantry officer on the ground with his platoon. So he was my back seat. And I was telling him about all this stuff and showing him the different areas that I had been flying over for quite a while. I think it was about 8 months at that time. And looking over there, out to the east, or the west was a low rolling hills going into Laos, and of course, like I said, nice big Tiger Mountain out there to the east. And I looked up at Tiger Mountain, and of all things, it was clear. No fog, no clouds, nothing whatsoever. And I said, Lieutenant, I said, you're in really real luck today. I said, I've been up here flying for about 8 months, 9 months, and I have never seen this clear before. I understand, I said, that there are waterfalls up there and crags and things back in that mountain, that whole tremendous majesty and beauty. And I said, let's go take a look at it. So we did, and we flew up there, and it was surely everything that we'd hoped to see. Absolutely. Beautiful rock outcroppings and waterfalls cascading down, and the lieutenant said, look, Major, he says, out to our left, 9 o'clock low, in the opening, in the falls. He said, elephants. And the clay out there, the ground is predominantly red clay, so they were rolling and spraying themselves. And he said, so I rolled the aircraft abruptly to the left and gazed down and heard 8 to 10 elephants, including several calves, and one of which appeared to be nursing from its mother. And he says, I don't believe it, they're all pink. And I told him why, you know, because they, the ground and so forth, that they're rolling and throwing the dirt and stuff on them, and they were wet. And he says, Major, he says, are we going to shoot them ourselves, or are we going to call in an airstrike or artillery strike? And I said, Lieutenant, we're not going to do either. No way. And I said, I realize in this hostile sector that we're in here, no known friendly personnel, no known enemy personnel, there are no pack marks on the backs of these animals because the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese would use elephants and water buffalo as instruments of transport for their arms and their ammunition. But there was nothing like that. There was no mark or anything like that on it. No force recon units had reported any activity around that area. These elephants had finally found themselves a respite from the war. They found a place they were safe. But Major, we're supposed to. And I said, I interrupted him and said, we're not reporting this. And if anyone asks anybody about this, or word gets out, and some trigger happy SOB goes looking for them, I'll have you over to see the flight surgeon, and you can explain the pretty pink elephants, to which I will personally deny, and you'll have your sorry ass grounded. Words to that effect. I said, do you understand what I'm saying? He says, reluctantly, he says, yes, sir. And he said, I said, if I thought that would make a difference in the war, I'd reconsider this. I said, it's not going to make a hill's darn bit of difference as far as the outcome of this war is concerned. So we're not going to report it. Do you understand? I said. A formal yes, sir, was the response, and we took another pass over them. An old bull was rolling on his back with all four legs in the air. The lieutenant exclaimed, that's just what my dog likes to do. My point was made and accepted. There was also a calf nursing from its mother. I mean, what more did you ever want to see up there? It was perfect. Since we didn't always fly with the same observer, it was several days later before I saw him again, and it was at nighttime. He was at a table in our makeshift officers' club sitting with some other lieutenants. And he'd had a few brews, and I caught his eye, and he gave me the sly grin and a thumbs up. And I gave him a thumbs up back, and I knew our little pact was honored and our secret was safe. A week later, I knew it would be honored forever. He was killed along with his pilot. And I knew his pilot pretty well. At least I hope we hopefully let something live on in that war that destroyed so much. And then I added this after I had written this, because I thought it was appropriate. We are defined not only by what we create, but by what we refuse to destroy.
Thank you very much.
Yep. I always have a little problem with that last part, but they're all personal. Yeah.
All right. Let's take a break.
Okay.
I appreciate that.